bag across the shop. It bounced off the far wall and landed on top of a dresser. He walked across to it and batted it aside. He drop-kicked it as it came down, and it hit the ceiling before falling on its side like a dead woodchuck. Then he simply stood, breathing hard, inhaling the heavy smells, staring vacantly at three chairs he had promised to Kane by the end of the week. His thumbs were jammed into his belt. His fingers were curled into fists. His lower lip was pooched out. He looked like a kid sulking after a bawling out. "Cheap shit," he breathed, and went after the flight bag. He made as if to kick it again, then changed his mind and picked it up. He went through the shed and into the three-room house that adjoined the shop. If anything, it was hotter in the house. Crazy July heat. It got in your head. The kitchen was full of dirty dishes. Flies buzzed around a green plastic hefty bag filled with beefaroni and tuna fish cans. The living room was dominated by a big old Zenith black-and-white TV he had rescued from the Naples dump. A big spayed brindle cat, name of Bernie Carbo, slept on top of it like a dead thing. The bedroom was where he worked on his writing. The bed itself was a rollaway, not made, the sheets stiff with cum, no matter how much he was getting, and over the last 2 weeks that had been zero, he masturbated a great deal. Masturbation, he believed, was a sign of creativity. Across from the bed was his desk. A big old-fashioned Underwood sat on top of it. Manuscripts were stacked to both sides. More manuscripts, some in boxes, some secured with rubber bands, were piled up in one corner. He wrote a lot, and he moved around a lot. And his main luggage was his work. Mostly poems, a few stories, a surreal play in which the characters spoke a grand total of 9 words, and a novel he had attacked badly from 6 different angles. It had been 5 years since he had lived in one place long enough to get completely unpacked. Last December, while shaving one day, he had discovered the first threads of gray in his beard. The discovery had thrown him into a savage depression, and he had stayed depressed for weeks. He hadn't touched a razor between then and now, as if it was the act of shaving that had somehow caused the gray to show up. He was 38. He refused to entertain the thought of being that old, but sometimes it crept up on his blind side and surprised him. To be that old, less than 700 days shy of 40, terrified him. He had really believed that 40 was for other people. That bitch, he thought over and over again. That bitch. He had left dozens of women since he had first gotten laid by a vague, pretty, softly helpless French substitute when he was a high school junior. But he himself had only been dropped 2 or 3 times. He was good at seeing the drop coming and opting out of the relationship first. It was a protective device, like bombing the Queen of Spades on someone else in a game of hearts. You had to do it while you could still cover the bitch, or you got screwed. You covered yourself, the way you didn't think about your age. He had known Donna was cooling it, but she had struck him as a woman who could be manipulated with no great difficulty, at least for a while, by a combination of psychological and sexual factors. By fear, if you wanted to be crude. That it hadn't worked that way left him feeling hurt and furious, as if he had been whipped raw. He got out of his clothes, tossed his wallet and change onto his desk, went into the bathroom, showered. When he came out, he felt a little better. He dressed again, pulling jeans and a faded chambray shirt from the flight bag. He picked his change up, put it in a front pocket, and paused, looking speculatively at his Lord Buxton. Some of the business cards had fallen out. They were always doing that because there were so many of them. Steve Kemp had a pack rat sort of wallet. One of the items he almost always picked up and tucked away were business cards. They made nice bookmarks, and the space on the blank flip side was just right for jotting an address, simple directions, or a phone number. He would sometimes take 2 or 3 if he happened to be in a plumbing shop or if an insurance salesman stopped by. Steve would unfailingly ask the 9-to-5er for his card with a big, shit-eating grin. When he and Donna were going at it hot and heavy, he had happened to notice one of her husband's business cards lying on top of the TV. Donna had been taking a shower or something. He had taken the business card. No big reason, just the pack rat thing. Now he opened his wallet and thumbed through the cards. Cards from prudential agents in Virginia, realtors in Colorado, a dozen businesses in between. For a moment he thought he had lost handsome hubby's card, but it had just slipped down between a couple of dollar bills. He fished it out and looked at it. White card, blue lettering done in modish lowercase, Mr. Businessman Triumphant. Quiet but impressive. Nothing flashy. Roger Breakstone, Ad Works, Victor Trenton, 1633 Congress Street, Telex, Ad Works, Portland, Maine, 04001. Telephone, area code 207-799-8600. Steve pulled a sheet of paper from a ream of cheap mimeo stuff and cleared a place in front of him. He looked briefly at his typewriter. No, each machine's typescript was as individual as a fingerprint. It was his crooked lowercase A that hung the blighter, Inspector. The jury was only out long enough to have tea. This would not be a police matter, no how, no way. But caution came without even thinking. Cheap paper, available at any office supply store. No typewriter. He took a Pilot razor point from the coffee can on the corner of the desk and printed in large block letters, "Hello, Vic. Nice wife you've got there. I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her." He paused, tapping the pen against his teeth. He was starting to feel good again, on top. Of course, she was a good-looking woman, and he supposed there was always the possibility that Trenton might discount what he had written so far. Talk was cheap, and you could mail someone a letter for less than the price of a coffee. But there was something, always something. What might it be? He smiled suddenly. When he smiled that way, his entire face lit up, and it was easy to see why he had never had much trouble with women since the evening with the vague, pretty French sub. He wrote, "What's that mole just above her pubic hair look like to you? To me, it looks like a question mark. Do you have any questions?" That was enough. A meal is as good as a feast, his mother had always said. He found an envelope and put the message inside. After a pause, he slipped the business card in and addressed the envelope, also in block letters, to Vic's office. After a moment's thought, he decided to show the poor slob a little mercy and added "personal" below the address. He propped the letter on the windowsill and leaned back in his chair, feeling totally good again. He would be able to write tonight. He felt sure of it. Outside, a truck with out-of-state plates pulled into his driveway, a pickup with a great big Hoosier cabinet in the back. Someone had picked up a bargain at a barn sale. Lucky them. Steve strolled out. He would be glad to take their money and their Hoosier cabinet, but he really doubted if he would have time to do the work. Once that letter was mailed, a change of air might be in order, but not too big a change, at least not for a while. He felt he owed it to himself to stay in the area long enough to make at least one more visit to Little Miss High Pockets, when it could be ascertained that handsome hubby was definitely not around, of course. Steve had played tennis with the guy, and he was no ball of fire. Thin, heavy glasses, spaghetti backhand. But you never knew when a handsome hubby was going to go off his gourd and do something antisocial. A good many handsome hubbies kept guns around the house, so he would want to check out the scene carefully before popping in. He would allow himself the one single visit, and then close this show entirely. He would maybe go to Ohio for a while, or Pennsylvania, or Taos, New Mexico. But like a practical joker who had stuffed a load into someone's cigarette, he wanted to stick around, at a prudent distance, of course, and watch it blow up. The driver of the pickup and his wife were peering into the shop to see if he was there. Steve strolled out, hands in the pockets of his jeans, smiling. The woman smiled back immediately. "Hi, folks, can I help you?" he asked, and thought that he would mail the letter as soon as he could get rid of them. That evening, as the sun went down red and round and hot in the west, Vic Trenton, his shirt tied around his waist by the arms, was looking into the engine compartment of his wife's Pinto. Donna was standing beside him, looking young and fresh in a pair of white shorts and a red-checked sleeveless blouse. Her feet were bare. Tad, dressed only in his bathing suit, was driving his trike